Climbing Gold is a production of Duct Tape Then Beer.
My name is Michael Kennedy. I've been climbing since about 1969.
I can't believe you've been climbing since 1969.
Well, I'm an old fucker, so what do you expect?
yeah, exactly. Michael Kennedy was a great alpinist in the U.S. who mostly climbed from the 70s until early 2000s, let's say. But maybe more importantly, he also ran Climbing Magazine for almost 20 years. So he's had an outsized impact on the climbing world.
I'm George Lowe, and I live above Golden, Colorado at about 2,300 meters or so, in sort of out in the countryside. I've been climbing 60 years at this point, and I'm still climbing.
George Lowe is a legendary alpinist who has put up new routes all over the world. In fact, he has a buttress named after him on Mount Everest on the East Face on a route that he put up. I feel like in some ways that's a good, like if someone has a part of Mount Everest named after them, you know that they did some climbing.
Yeah.
Jim Donini, and I live in Ouray, Colorado, and it's starting to snow.
Well, Jim Donini has in some ways outgrown his original climbing accomplishments. Like, I don't even know what Jim Donini has climbed over the years because he's just a legend at this point. You know, it's like, I mean, he's an 80-year-old who's been contributing to the climbing world for the last 60 years, 55 years or something. So, I mean, I don't know. He's put up routes all over the world. He's been motivated. He's, contributed to the American Alpine Club. Like, he's just been a fixture of the American climbing community for, twice as long as I've been alive, practically. How long have you been climbing, Jim?
Since 1964, so that's 59 years.
I thought you were going to say that's before they invented math. It's like really hard to know how long you've been climbing.
Christ was a corporal. It was so long ago. But George has me beat, I think.
Man, I just don't often talk to people who've been climbing for 60 years. Like that's pretty proud.
Well, I still love it.
The North Ridge of Leitaquan. In the world of hard alpinism, this route is a legend. 45 years ago, four friends pushed the spirit of alpinism to a new height. The nearly completed line they left behind would become a sort of holy grail that rebuffed the next two generations of elite alpine climbers, even as standards rose and gear improved. So much so, there were so many failed attempts that people wondered, would it ever be climbed?
Today we talk with Michael, George, and Jim, the surviving members of what many consider the dream team of hard alpine climbing, about one of climbing's most beautiful failures and the legend that it spawned. I'm Alex Honnold.
I'm Fitz Cahal.
This is Climbing Gold.
Alex, where is Leitaquan?
So Leitaquan is in the Karakoram in Pakistan, near K2, and it sits in this incredible amphitheater on the Choktoy Glacier, and the North Ridge dominates the valley.
It's actually on the same way that you go up towards K2, except you don't go as far up. You walk into a skull, drive into a skully now, but we had to walk into a skully then. And from there, you'll walk up the drainage of the Baltoro and you go a short distance and then you turn left towards the Choktoy Glacier and follow the Choktoy Glacier up to the base of Leitaquan.
Can one of you guys describe Leitaquan and what it is and what the North Ridge looks like?
It's just a classic big buttress ridge going to a sharp pointy summit. I mean, it's just beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful routes I've ever been on.
And the climb is roughly 2,500 or so meters, 8,000 feet. And the rock is basically pretty darn good. There's never an incredibly difficult pitch on it, but there's almost never a very easy pitch. If you stay on the ridge itself, the objective hazards are not terribly bad. unless it gets really warm and the cornices start collapsing. There are cornices along the ridge that you have to traverse under. But it's a very, very interesting climb because you're climbing rock, you're climbing mixed, you're climbing ice, you're at high altitude.
Had the North Ridge of Laytock 1 been attempted when you guys went in there? Was it already an objective for alpinism?
I don't think so.
No, I'm pretty sure not.
I'm almost certain it was not. I mean, I just picked it up in one of the Shipton books. I saw the picture of it because I have always admired what Shipton and Tillman did in terms of going light and fast. You know, they did some incredible explorations in the whole Karakoram, particularly in that area of Pakistan, what's Pakistan at the present time.
But so you really just saw a picture of it in the book and decided that that looks like a fantasy route, and you guys went and tried it, and then you created one of the gems of alpinism, really.
Well, I don't know. We created it. We didn't finish it.
In the summer of 1978, George Lowe, Jim Dineen, Michael Kennedy, and the late Jeff Lowe were at the cutting edge of climbing. They were part of a growing movement of mountain climbers that were leaving behind the slow and heavy expeditions of the past in favor of an emerging form of alpinism known as alpine style. Small teams climb light and fast, usually in a single push with minimal fixed ropes. The commitment level goes through the roof. Although alpine style climbing was becoming more commonplace in lower ranges like the Canadian Rockies and the Swiss Alps, it was still revolutionary to take these tactics to the high peaks of the Himalaya and the Karakoram. So for many alpinists, the next logical training ground was Alaska.
George and I had climbed in Alaska the year before, and we had done a couple of routes, one on Mount Hunter, and the big one was the Infinite Spur on Mount Foraker. You know, George was one of my heroes because, of course, I knew about him. And I didn't meet him till I got up to Alaska because we were climbing with Jeff Lowe, and Jeff and I had climbed together a little bit. And then Jeff ended up breaking his ankle 4,000 feet up Mount Hunter. So we had to go down with him and send him out. And then George and I were left there, and we said, okay, well, I guess we'll go on to Foraker. And it was a huge project. It's like a 9,000-foot face. Hadn't been done. It's sort of remote for the Alaska range. And so we spent 10 or 11 days on that and went through some mixed climbing and some rock climbing and big packs because it was the old days and you didn't go that fast. Anyway, we got done that and we had a really good time climbing together. And then George and Jeff were already planning this trip to Laytock, so they invited me to come along. And we wanted a fourth because it was a big project. And I knew Jim a little bit, and those guys knew him a little bit. So we invited him because we knew he was badass, basically, and he'd be a good addition. So, you know, that ended up being the team.
I was the oldest climber. George was one year younger than me. And then I think Michael and Jeff were about 5 years younger than George. So there was an age difference, but it wasn't extreme.
And so what did you guys all bring to the team?
We had all done pretty hard first ascents in alpine climbing. And I felt privileged to be invited to climb with George and Jeff and Michael. We had four people who all had a lot of experience in that kind of climbing. And we just got along well, too.
One of the beauties of the team, in my mind, is we are reasonably well-balanced in terms of our skill levels. And we all probably had the necessary skills to lead any pitch on the climb.
You know, Jeff was probably the best all-around climber of us. You know, he was a very good rock climber, super good ice climber and mixed climber. So he was best all around. Jim was, I think, probably a little bit better rock climber, maybe even than Jeff. And at that point, he didn't have this massive amount of ice climb experience, but he was fine with that. George, of course, had a massive amount of experience in the alpine, as well as being a pretty darn good rock climber. And I was a young gun, so I think I was maybe sort of overstoked or overenthusiastic.
Do you guys remember your first impressions looking up at the route? Like after the long trek in up the glaciers and you finally get to the base of the North Ridge of Laytock 1, what did you guys think when you saw it?
You know, when people come into Yosemite the first time from Fresno, from the south, And you go through the tunnel and get that view of El Cap, and you go, oh, my God. Well, that's what it was like. I said, oh, my God, look at that thing.
Being in the rural mountains in Pakistan in 1978, I mean, on an expedition like that, you wouldn't have any communications with home until you were back home again, basically. I mean, it's crazy because there's no communication with camp. Camp has no communication with the rest of the world. I mean, it's hard to overstate how remote something like that would feel with no communications. And I think that's the hard thing with comparing epics from the last generations to any kind of modern climbing, is that it's just so different to be completely alone. You know, it's like if you can text home anytime you want with your little satellite thing and get weather updates nonstop and things like that, it's just not the same as being totally detached from the world.
We were trying to do this, George said, in the best style that we possibly could, given our skill set at the time and the state of the art of climbing at the time.
And again, this was a time when you didn't have sat phones or anything like that. I mean, you were sort of like stepping off the edge of the world.
And also, to climb, we had no beta. It was, every pitch was brand new to us. And so I think a lot of climbs that people know that this particular section is going to be really hard rock, or this particular section is going to be really hard mixed climbing, but we never knew what the next pitch would be until we got there. Mm-hmm.
We talked about ahead of time. Ideally, we just do a pure alpine sale, just, you know, pack in your back, just go. But we brought enough stuff so that we could do this capsule style, which was, you know, again, if it was really difficult, you'd fix some ropes, maybe spend a couple days on a section, then move your camp up.
We never had an umbilical cord, a fixed rope going from a base camp to where we were so that supplies could be brought up.
Yeah, and so why did you guys try capsule style instead of expedition style?
Well, we liked it on an alpine style, but we figured there's just no hope that we could have done it with our skill set at the time and perhaps the gear that was available at the time. So that was the way that we could conceivably get up the peak and do it in the best style that we are capable of doing.
Which was capsule style.
Right.
You know, it was just a really different era. Like the idea of going as quickly as you go now is just, it was beyond our imagination, essentially, especially on the technical ground.
So after weeks spent on the approach and a few days of resting, acclimatizing, and packing gear at base camp, the team set off in early July.
We end up carrying about 17 days of food, heavy 17 days of food.
The buttress comes right down to the glacier, but we bypass the first 400 or 500 feet in a snow gully to the left because we wanted to get as high as we could as quickly as we could. And then you had a long section that was mostly rock climbing, quite good rock climbing, not particularly difficult. We probably climbed some 5.9 and pull up on gear, and maybe you'd have a short head wall where you'd make a couple aid moves, things like that.
Initially, the team had almost 350 pounds of gear split between them. Each day, two climbers would lead, while the other two jumarred fixed lines, shuttling back-breaking loads. It was grueling work.
And then there was a long section of sort of corniced ridge, and it was very, very exposed. And it sort of went a little horizontal, so you're going back a bit. So you're traversing quite a bit.
You know, I have some pictures. I have a picture of Michael Kennedy doing it, starting to lead an ice traverse on about 70 degree ice. And this photograph shows him, his left hand is a Chouinard Alpine hammer. And his right hand is a 70 centimeter long ice axe, straight shafted. And, you know, that was those were the best tools available at the time.
And so is that the kind of gear you guys were using on Latok?
On Latok, George had a 70 centimeter Chouinard PLA. I had a Forest metal ice axe with interchangeable picks, which was like brand new. I mean, that was like the first time that anyone had done something like that. And then a Chouinard Alpine hammer, which is like a wooden handle with like a, you know, a hammer head and then like a little pick.
Hmm. Like a prospector's hammer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Like
a little more sophisticated.
You were doing some alpine prospecting. You're up there prospecting for new routes.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, cams were not in existence at that time.
Yeah, no, that's crazy. It's a crazy thing now with ultralight ropes, ultralight gear, like everything is just so much warmer and lighter and more comfortable.
Absolutely.
And easier. It's like, man, it's such a different world.
We had leather boots. The shank in the boot was a piece of hardwood, made them rigid. They were called Hobbler Superlights, and they weren't very light. Compared to today's boots, they weren't light at all.
We'll be back with more after the break.
George, do you remember what the climbing was like on the North Ridge?
There was a middle section, well, probably two-thirds of the way up, where there was this really brilliant section of mixed places where you had your crampon on a piece of ice that's a couple of centimeters thick, and your other foot is on the rock, and you got an ice axe in and a handhold, and just this mixture of ice and rock where you were sometimes fully on the rock and sometimes fully on the ice. It was really great. And the other place I remember is just getting up to the place where we had our final bivouac in the snow cave, this really gleaming sheet of quite steep ice.
Oh, yeah.
The temperatures were just right. I just remember my ice tools going in perfectly, just thunk every time, no problem. And it just felt glorious getting up with the sun on us. And I was thinking, man, we're going to climb this thing. We're over the crux. And it felt so good to be feeling like that at that altitude. You were probably over 7,000 meters at that point in time. And it was just a wonderful feeling to be there with, you know, you could see K2 in the background, and a phenomenal place to be.
But even though the climbing was incredible, the overall weight of the experience began to take a toll.
We had 17 days of food, which sounds like a lot. But consider that when you're on a climb at altitude doing that amount of work, it's like you're on half rations all the time, because you maybe have rations here for 3,000, 2,000 calories a day, and you're burning 5 or 6. There was a time when I wrapped back down to get some to get a load while everybody else was doing something, I forget. And I had a heavy load, and I'm jumaring up, and all of a sudden, about halfway up, I lost it. I felt really, really tired. I started crying. I really did. I made it back up and I recovered. But it was very trying, that climb. I mean, day after day. And when the storm came in, the first storm lower down, we went on half rations. We just sat there for several days on half rations. Really, half rations is a quarter rations of what you actually need.
You all were stretched pretty thin. You know, did you guys ever butt heads? Were there disagreements?
There was never any conflict, and there was never any feeling that, oh, I'm doing more than everybody else, or so-and-so is not pulling their weight. I mean, that was, I think, one of the most sort of special things about the trip.
It really was joyful, a good fraction of the time. I can remember Jeff in particular on a hard mixed pitch. He got up to this overhang, and it was clearly quite hard. And he says, God, this is so much fun. I mean, that was the way we felt.
A climb like that has a lot of problem solving. It's not like having a crack system going straight up an old cap and in pretty obvious line. You're always saying, so which way do we go? What do we do now? So the climbing, as George said, was never terribly hard. It was never very easy either. And you always had to really work through the puzzle of where the next pitch was going to go.
I mean, solving these problems, I mean, it's the reason I love climbing and still love climbing.
And that wasn't just a hypoxia or delirium or, you know?
Well, it could have been.
What's the longest you've spent on a wall?
Well, I've spent 4 days on El Cap a couple times on different routes. We probably spent 4 or 5 days climbing this wall in Borneo once. Maybe it was 3 or 4 days. I don't know. We were stuck in a storm for a day. I mean, I don't think I've really spent more than 4 days on a route.
Is 4 days on a route enough?
I mean, to me, 4 or 5 days on a route is enough. But I mean, to be fair though, that's also with a slightly more modern style. Or like, you know, when we did the Fitztraverse, we were en route. I think we camped four times. And that felt like enough. But we also were climbing with much lighter loads, moving much more quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a different world.
Yeah.
And we were in a high altitude. It's like, it's, you know, hard to even compare. It's just hard to imagine spending 26 days on one face. I mean, the other thing hearing this whole story, though, is that it's just hard to compare to anything modern, because nowadays you have weather forecasts, you have communications with the outside world, you have a sat forecast. And so if you're that high on a mountain and you see the forecast that a 6-day storm is coming in, you would probably just retreat then, knowing that you're about to be in for this incredible epic. But since those guys didn't have any kind of communications, they just wait and see and hope that each day that the storm will get better. And then when the storm doesn't get better, just rappel in a storm. And it's like, those are just not the sorts of things that you do nowadays, because you don't need to.
We knew where we were based on our observations of it from when we were down below. And we thought that we had it in the bag. We had a couple of things going. There was a steep, about 60-meter head wall right behind this huge mound of snow. So every day, two people would push the route leading, and the other two would stay behind and tumor up the fixed ropes with heavy loads. That day, Jeff and I were the work dogs, and Michael and George were leading the climb. So we got to that point. We had time left in the day.
Meanwhile, George and I went over, and I led this one A2 or A3 pitch, and George led another short pitch above that. So we'd have a couple ropes fixed. And then we're hoping then from there, we would hit these, what looked like some relatively straightforward snow and ice slopes up to the summit ridge, and then along the summit ridge to the top. So we felt like we were like a day from the top at that point.
Meanwhile, Jeff and I start digging a snow cave. So as you know, a snow cave is a bomb-proof shelter in the mountains. All hell can be breaking loose outside, and you're inside warm and cozy. So we thought, great, we'll have a snow cave. They'll fix the rope on the head wall. We'll leave everything behind in the snow cave. The next day, we'll go to the summit. We'll tag the summit. We'll come back down to the snow cave, spend the night, and then start back down. So we had this high level of optimism. Of course, two things happened. One is, halfway through digging the snow cave, I poke my head out and I could see a storm coming in from the southwest, from the bad direction. And at about the same time, Jeff started feeling ill. So it went from having this incredible feeling of elation about, we are going to do this climb, that there's so many days and so much pain and so much work, to, well, we're in maybe a little trouble now.
So how sick was Jeff?
He was in and out of consciousness, pretty sick.
Yeah, I've got a picture of him in the snow cave, and he was clearly very hypoxic. His face is blue, and bluntly, I thought he was going to die.
And what actually happened to Jeff? How did he get so acutely sick so quickly?
Jeff thought it was due to the fact he'd had been sick on the approach in when we were hiking into Scully. My personal thought is Jeff had struggled on other climbs with altitude. He didn't seem to altitude acclimatize quite as well. And who knows, it may have been a combination of both. But he was clearly very, very hypoxic there. And was it due to a recurrence of something else he had, or just not getting pulmonary edema, but just suffering from the effects of altitude? It's very hard to tell.
As the weather worsened, so did Jeff's condition. But even though he was in rough shape, he said he would give it one more try. The team had come too far.
We actually did make an attempt, and we got another pitch above the hard rock pitch. When watching Jeff go up trying to jumar up the hard rock pitch, it was just clear that he couldn't function, and we couldn't take the risk. I mean, conceivably, two of us might have been able to go to the summit, but you can't leave somebody behind, or you can't leave a pair behind in that sort of situation. The storm was bad, but we were climbing in it. You know, it wasn't blowing horrendously hard, and it wasn't terribly cold. Now, it's at 7,000 meters, since you don't have very much oxygen, It doesn't have to be very cold because your body's not generating very much heat. You just don't have enough oxygen to burn your food adequately to perform well. At least that was true of us.
So it was just totally out of the question to split up the team or leave Jeff behind for a little while.
We never considered it. In fact, we never talked about it.
Right. I just, ethically, in my mind, that simply is unacceptable.
Especially the condition he was in.
Yeah.
He could have worsened while we were on the climb. We had no idea. We felt that you climb together, everybody gets to the summit or nobody does.
So you guys talked about having good days and bad days, but I'm curious, like being stuck in that snow cave for 4 or 5 days, what do you talk about? What do you laugh about? How do you keep yourself sane for that many days inside of a snow cave? Which is basically, I feel like that snow cave must be like being on the moon. You know, you're so far away from the ground. You know, what do you do?
I don't remember well enough, but a lot of it is just, you know, doing the things you have to do to stay alive, getting the melting snow for water, trying to get some food.
You know, when you hang out with somebody in a little tent for like a fucking month, right? It's like you can't stand the way they chew their food, right? Or they have some other little personal habit that just gets on your nerves, right? But that's just human nature.
I don't remember what we talked about. It must have been pretty mundane because we were all pretty tired. I think a lot of it's just sort of absorbed in your own thoughts a good fraction of the time.
That's right.
I mean, look at the picture of Jim in the snow cave. His face is all hollowed out. And his stare is just, you could tell he had lost the weight. And Jeff wasn't saying anything. He was semi-conscious.
I mean, he was like coughing and headaches and couldn't keep any food down and just was sort of lying off in the corner.
But I don't recall talking. I think you're right. A lot of the time we just spent there trying to relax, trying to get some sleep, and just our thoughts were internal. We didn't talk a lot to each other.
And we had some great food in the snow cave. We had Pakistani chicken soup with these god-awful Pakistani sausages that left little bits of grease floating in the chicken soup. And somehow you had to gag this down at 7,000 meters.
You know, I have a picture of me in the snow cave. I look worse than Jeff with all the weight I lost. But anyway, I'm lying down in the snow cave. It's storming outside. We know we're not going anywhere that day. We have very little food left, but we did have what George described as these Pakistani sausage. We called them donkey dicks. And I remember, okay, I have to eat. So I'm lying there and I get the stove going and I boil up one of these sausages in water. And then I fell asleep for some reason. I woke up a little while later. And the sausage was sitting in the water, but all the fat had congealed. The sausage was sitting in this congealed fat. I looked at it and said, I'm starving to death, but there's no way I can eat that.
So did you not eat it?
I did not eat it.
But I did.
Man, that is so grim. We'll be back with more after the break. So how bad was the storm and how many days were you guys in the snow cave?
You know, we spent that time in the snow cave 4 or 5 days. I can't remember which. And we decided we had to go down.
That first day of the descent was fucking crazy.
Yeah. We left Jeff's pack up there and actually one of the teams found it when they climbed it, and we'd lower Jeff down the rope that had been fixed by the first repeller, and then he'd get Jeff tied in and safe, and then we'd do the last two people had come down, and we'd just repeat that process. And we got down, 1,000, 1,500 feet or something like that, you know, first day, maybe 400 meters, and we had to bivouac in the open, in the storm, on a small ledge, and I thought, you know, Jeff isn't going to survive the night.
Jim told me later that he thought he was going to wake up to a dead body.
I remember that bivouac. It was out in the open. We were just basically sitting on the ledge next to each other.
Right.
The spindrift avalanches came down all night long. I remember Jeff was right next to me. I woke up. I looked over to Jeff. He was slumped over, covered in snow. And I thought, oh, God, he died.
And I remember in the morning awaking and calling over, how's Jeff? And Jeff said, I feel great. And I thought, oh, my God. What a relief, because trying to get him all the way down where we're having to basically guide his rappels would have taken much longer than it took.
So Jeff did recover as you guys got lower?
Yes.
That's correct.
By the time we got to the bottom, he was probably in better shape than the rest of us.
Man.
Maybe it was because we got down lower in altitude. And I think we did, at least on the wraps, George counted the wraps, we did 85 pitches. Isn't that right, George? Or
I can't remember.
I remember somewhere that you guys did 100 rappels getting down. I was like, that is so
I thought
rappels.
It was more like 85. I don't know.
It was like 90 rappels.
Somewhere in that range.
Maybe it's fair to just round up when you start getting into the high 80s on your rappels. You know, you're just like, well, it's an absurd amount of rappelling. 90 pitches of rappelling is insane. I mean, 90 pitches of rappelling is like rappelling El Cap three times, but that actually doesn't really do it justice because rappelling the nose three times would only take you, you know, half a day, let's say, because they're good anchors and it's clean and it's vertical. But rappelling 90 pitches on something like the North Ridge of Latok requires walking around on ice and down climbing things and building all the anchors, which takes forever, and equalizing the anchors. And there's stuff falling all around you and you're really tired because you're at high altitude. So 90 pitches of rappelling on a mountain like that is an insanely long ordeal.
Yeah. When you measure rappelling in days, you're in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, I rappelled the Southeast Ridge of Saratore over 12 hours, let's say, and that's something like 20 or 30 pitches. And it took half a day with two sort of elite rappellers, because I mean, we were employing all the speed tactics too. We were samurapping. We were, you know, my partner knew the route super well. It's like one of those things where even speed style, it takes 12 hours to rappel an alpine ridge like that. And that's only, you know, a third or a quarter of the size of Latok. Like, can you imagine rappelling something that long? It's crazy. It's so long. What are the total details? Like, how many days were you on route? How many days were you trying to go up? And then you were stuck in the storm for a few days, and then you spent 4 days rappelling the route. But, you know, what was the total time on the North Ridge?
My memory is it's 26 days.
Yeah, so how did you guys maintain morale as you slowly starved for a month?
Well, we're having great climbing.
I mean, but
that's enough to maintain a lot of morale.
But great climbing only gets you so far, though. I mean, if you want great climbing, you could have stayed in Yosemite. You know, it's like,
yeah, but Yosemite's wonderful, and you know, don't take it wrong. I, you know, the times I've spent in Yosemite are phenomenal, but it's not the Karakoram. The vertical extent of the climbs are just, more than double what the biggest climbs in Yosemite are, where it's technical. Now, obviously, the pitches were not as hard as climbing the nose, say, on El Cap. And from my perspective, we were pushing our limits and it felt great. I mean, I never felt like I was too close to the edge on the climb, except when Jeff got sick. And so, you know, we're having this really interesting climbing in this incredible environment, you know, doing presumably the first ascent of this peak by the prettiest route on the peak in my mind. That's pretty good for keeping morale up. Now, our morale was not so high in the snow cave.
I concur with what George said. I don't think we ever talked about going down. We never considered it. It just never entered our minds. I realized that we started really stretching the umbilical cord as we got higher. But I also remember that when we decided to go down, when Jeff was obviously not going to be able to make it to the summit, it started snowing and the weather come back in, George and Michael and I just looked at each other, and I don't think anybody said a word. We just started down. So we had this, after all those days, we developed this sort of bond between us that was unbreakable in a lot of ways. And it stayed unbreakable. The fact that we did go down when we needed to, we had stretched the umbilical cord as far as we could. You know, in alpine climbing, you have to be very pushy. It's very easy to come up with a good reason to go down. And you'll never get up a climb if you do that. But it's a very delicate balance between not pushing hard enough and pushing too hard. Because if you push too hard, you're never going to get to climb again. I always go by the adage, getting up is optional, getting back down is obligatory. But we had really pushed hard, I think harder than many people would have. But we knew when it was time to bail. It was that kind of relationship we had with each other. It's hard to explain.
It's definitely fair to say that you guys pushed hard when you went 26 days on 17 days of food through two storms and everybody got down safely. You're like, that's a big outing in the mountains. That's a pretty incredible, that's a journey.
We got down, remember the last day was brilliant sunshine, perfect weather. Yeah, so we're hiking back to camp and I was a little ahead of everybody. We got, the glacier had changed in all that time. The fern line had gone up, it was bare ice. When we first started, it was snow on the glacier. And then we got to the East Moraine where a lot of boulders, we had our camp and I couldn't recognize anything. I knew I was near our base camp, but I just didn't recognize anything. All of a sudden, around a corner, came our cook, Muhammad, and he saw me, and he started crying. They hadn't heard or seen from us. They hadn't seen our lights or anything for about 2 weeks. He was there with the liaison officer. There were only two people in camp. And he saw me, came over and hugged me and just started crying. And then I remember we were starving. He started cooking us sweet chapatis. And I gobbled down as many as I could. That night I went to bed on top of a boulder because I didn't feel very secure on the ground. And those chapatis came back all of a sudden. I just leaned over the side of the boulder and lost all that food.
I'm sort of impressed that your cook and liaison officer spent 2 weeks by themselves just hoping that you guys would come back at some point.
The liaison officer had gotten even fatter. On the way in, he was a little bit chubby. We called him Captain No Loads. He wouldn't carry anything. And I guess what I found out later that he sat the entire time in the tent and he had a radio of some sort listening to Pakistani pop music.
Man. Were they going to leave you guys at some point? Like, would they have just gone home in another week if they didn't hear from you?
We don't know. It wouldn't have made too much difference to us getting out as long as they left some food there. It wouldn't have been a big issue because we basically had to carry our loads out anyway.
And at that point, did you guys just cache some of the loads or bury some stuff and just abandon ship? Because you're just in survival mode, staggering off the mountain.
I know we didn't bring everything out.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way if you have that much weight, that much rope, and you're starving and it's the end of the trip. You're just like, you know what? Let's just save it here for next season, even though you know you're never coming back.
I don't remember. Oh, we did come back, though, in 2016.
Guys... What?
Yeah. So many years is that, George? Let's see. 38 years later, we come back.
So it's really a testament to the partnership that you guys are all still friends. Did it feel that way on the climb?
So large expeditions, they got a pecking order. Some people feel, oh, I've done all this work and I'm not going to get to go to the summit. So it always seems, in all the stories I've read about these large Himalayan expeditions, they all had discord and backbiting and little cliques would form. We didn't have that at all. I think we liked everybody, each other before we went, and we still did on the way down, and we still do now.
How much of a testament do you think it is to their skill or their teamwork or, you know, just the hard work too, that it did, you know, even as the gear got way better, you know, people are carrying packs that are half the weight essentially. That I don't know. I feel like that says something because I don't think routes that become such a big ticket item in such a big ticket location sit, you know, don't get sent. I think it's pretty crazy. I think that it took to 2018 essentially.
Yeah, I'm like, what is that? So that's 22. That's 40 years later. It took 40 years for somebody to actually climb the route that they almost climbed. And even then, they didn't actually climb the exact route.
Yeah.
Which, it's crazy. I mean, I think though, as Michael Kenney was saying, though, it probably is a little bit of a testament to changing styles and changing expectations of climbers. Because I think that when Michael and Jeff and George and Jim, I was like, man, that's confusing. Jeff, George, and Jim. It's like a all-American team right there. It's like they should all be like middle linebackers or something, you know. But anyway, when that team attempted Laytock, you know, it's like they just weren't quite at the right era to go full alpine style. They just didn't quite have the gear yet. But then later teams trying it, you know, sort of had different expectations. Like they didn't want to spend 26 days on the wall because they didn't think they would have to. And it seems like the reality is that the route is hard enough and complicated enough that it kind of demands a lot of time on the wall and but nobody else was quite prepared or aspiring to that amount of toil. Yeah, I mean, I think there are plenty of other examples of that with like old school sort of folks doing something the hard way because they expect it to be really hard and putting tons of work into it. And then when, you know, a more modern climber comes along and they're like, oh, I want this to feel a little bit easier. And the reality is just that it's not that easy. And you're like, oh, geez. And then it's hard to do it without putting that work in. You know, it's been 45 years since the Northridge Laytock One. What does the climb mean to you guys now?
It was sort of like an evolutionary step. It was a very powerful trip, and it was really cool, and it was super exciting. It was my first time in the Himalayas, so it sort of opened up some ideas. It opened a door to other climbs, and even in retrospect, it felt like a sort of evolutionary step. And then, you know, and then it took other steps and tried all kinds of other things, mostly failed and got up a few other things. But
for me, a wonderful shared experience. I look back at that as one of the finest experiences of my life.
Did the experience on Laytock change you guys as climbers or change you as people? Besides losing a ton of weight?
I don't think so. I think that it made... For me, it made the kind of climbing that I wanted to do and had been doing, it made it more special in that I continued on in that. I decided after that climb that I would never be involved in an expedition, a large expedition. It would always be with a couple, one or two others. In fact, in the last 30 years, almost all my climbs have been just with one other partner. And, you know, I think about climbing right now. I've been doing it for a long time. I've conducted a lot of clinics. I was a guide in the Tetons. I had clinics at Indian Creek for a number of years. So I've climbed with probably more than 1,000 people. But when you think of the alpine climbing I've done in my life, I can count the total number of partners on the fingers of my hands. 10 partners over 45, 50 years of alpine climbing. Because one of the real things that I treasure about alpine climbing is the team, the camaraderie that you develop, the bonds that you develop. And I tell young climbers who ask me about what do I need to do or know about big mountain climbs, I say, well, the most important thing for you is to get the right partner. You want somebody you get along with that has about the same level of commitment. They're willing to push through when they're tired. They're willing to push through when things seem grim, but they kind of know when to stop and when they come back. You don't want people to have more commitment or less commitment. You want to have someone, you know, and another thing, think about 26 days. You can't bring your A game every day. You have bad days and good days. And so it's important to have a partner that can be there when you're having a bad day, and they can be the strong one. And you can do the same for them. You know, I started climbing. I was in special forces on a 12-man A team, operational team. And that's when I really learned about partnerships and how you had to trust and like everybody on the team and know that they had your back when things were grim. So you develop, I think, with alpine climbing, with a small team, with one or other partner, or in our case, a team of four, the bond that you build is pretty special. And I don't see that happening for me in any other facet of life. I think that the bonds that I build in those climbs are the strongest bonds I've ever had with anyone.
Yeah, I mean, 26 days with a team, it's got to do some, you know, that's a real team building exercise. Even special forces don't do that.
You all have touched on this a bunch, but, you know, the bond you formed on that climb was lasting. And you never all had an experience quite like that again together. But what have those friendships come to mean down the road? And obviously, you lost Jeff 7 or 8 years ago. What have these friendships come to mean to you?
Well, as you get older, grow older, I think friendships become more important because you can sit around and talk a lot about the experiences that you can no longer really have. It's just pretty special. And George, as I said, George and I climbed the Black Canyon. We even climbed a little bit in Patagonia. I have a house in the northern part near the northern ice field. In 2019, George came down. Never been in Patagonia before. We went into a place called the Aviano Towers, where the approach was more difficult than the climbing. And we did a little new route on a little tiny tower. It was only about 5.6 or 5.7, real easy climbing. We got to the top, and the weather changed a little bit. It was kind of cold and breezy. We were at the top, and I had some of Jim Bridwell's ashes with me. Peggy Bridwell gave me his ashes, and she said, scatter them in Patagonia, you know, because he'd love to climb there. And then we did. I just scattered the ashes, and a condor flew by. It was, kind of special. So now I think that, for me anyway, when I go climbing with somebody, I go with them because I want to have that kind of a feeling of camaraderie, and not so much about the technical climbing as it is about the experience with the person you're with.
Thanks, Michael, George, and Jim, for sharing your story. In 2018, after 30 attempts by different parties, Laytock One received an ascent of the north side via variation of the North Ridge. That same summer, two Russians, Alexander Gukov and Sergei Glazunov, were able to follow the 1978 line past the high point to where it connected to the summit ridge. But on the descent, Glazunov fell, rappelling, stranding Gukov for 6 days before the Pakistani military completed a dramatic long line rescue via helicopter. Climbing Gold is a production of Duct Tape Then Beer. Alex Honnold is our host. Today's episode was produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Evan Phillips with help from me, Fitzka Hall. Music by Evan Phillips, Joanna Katcher, David Swenson, and Drexler. Our producer is Lauren Delaney Miller. Our executive producers are Ben Endy and Jonathan Retzek for RXR Sports, and Lisa Hendricks and Becca Cahal for Duct Tape Then Beer. Thanks for listening.